on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome to the Orient Hour. I'm joined tonight by my regular co-host, Jamie Stripe, and by special guest, Ricky Otto, who's going to give us the second part of the interview that we started earlier on in the month. Right, let's crack straight on then. 2-0 win over Southend United. Great to be back to winning ways, especially over our local rivals. Jamie, what did you make of the game?
Well, at last, back to winning ways, and it's going to be Happy New Year at last.
Yes.
Stop the rot. Stop rot. And it wasn't a great Southend team we were up against, but the main thing is we've got that win and we can take that forward into the new year and hopefully build upon the 10th place we find ourselves in the table tonight.
I was saying earlier on to someone on the WhatsApp group that we're on, a 4-0 win to us wouldn't have been out of place or unjustified.
No, because I thought we were a better side than the first half. We made some big chances. I mean, Wilkinson should have had two. The one he got cleared off the line, you know, on the, I think if it fell on his left foot, I think he'd have scored.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You know, we definitely should have gone into that second half 2-0 up. But, you know, in saying that, we looked reasonably solid right the way through the game, I thought. You know, I don't think Southend got one big chance, really, apart from a shot early in the second half. But overall, we were looking for a consistent 90 minutes team performance, and I think we virtually got one.
What did you make of the changes that were made? So, obviously, Leanne Gold coming in, Brophy moving to left-back, and Tunji Akinola getting his first start at centre-half in the league.
Yeah, I think, obviously, we had defensive problems against Cambridge, didn't we? I mean, Cambridge, they had a few chances, and we didn't look at the races at all defensively. I thought we looked a lot tighter tonight. I thought Akinola coming in did the simple things well, didn't he? Came in, you know, had a bit of pace about him. I don't think anyone was going to run past him. For going back to left back.
What you were saying about Akinola's pace, I actually think that helped Sam Ling as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think Ling was, you know, one of our top three performers on the night. You know, I know he gets a lot of stick, but you know, you can't take it away from him. I thought he played well. I think it's good that we've gone back to how we kind of started the season. If you look at it, that's virtually the starting lineup from earlier in the season. But I think it was a decent few changes he made.
I was frustrated when I saw the initial lineup that we were still playing 4-3-3. I thought it was frustrating to see Leanne Gold put out wide on the left. I didn't think it would have suited him, but actually, I thought he had a decent game.
Yeah, I did. He did a lot of tidying up at the back, doesn't he? You know, in that position. I mean, going forward, I still think, you know, he's an acquired taste for some of our support. But I think overall, I think that side has sort of picked 95 Southend a little bit. They were on a bit of a run. We needed to change it. And I don't think we were in any real sort of trouble during the whole match.
Great free kick by Joby Mack, enough to open the scoring as well.
Yeah, superb. I mean, again, when you want a bit of quality in a game like that, up steps the skipper to score an absolute screamer. I know Southend weren't too happy about the wall as far back as it went. I mean, I think Matt Simpson actually tweeted that they're at a disadvantage because they had to set it up behind the goal, which is quite fun. But, you know, Joby buried it, and, you know, you can't ask for more than that, really, can't you? I mean, the one bit of quality we've got in our midfield, and, you know, is it at the moment, he's irreplaceable, really, isn't he?
Yeah, and obviously a big January coming up. You know, obviously we know there's a lot of contracts that are out in the summer. So, you know, hopefully Ross will be allowed to strengthen the side.
Well, yeah, you want fresh faces coming in. You know, it's obvious that we're not the finished article. If we get a couple of decent signings in, we could pull off a promotional playoff run. But then again, you could say the same for 10 other teams, couldn't you? So it's all in the balance. January is going to be massive. The next two or three league games are going to be massive, not only for the club, but for some of the players and even the management.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree. Okay, all right. So we've had to whiz through that because we've now have Ricky Otto joining us for the next part of his interview.
Fantastic. I'm looking forward to this. And I've even cracked open the celebratory beer for once. There we go.
Okay, so welcome to Ricky Otto. We'd like to welcome you to the Orient Hour today, Ricky. How are you? How was your Christmas?
Not bad. I'm good. I'm still kind of just trying to wean myself off the festivities, man. I feel stuffed. I feel full. And I'm just trying to kind of just not eat as much now and just kind of get back to normality. But good to have you on here, man.
Yeah, plenty of turkey and stuffing?
Just a bit. I know I said to my wife when she was sharing out the dinner, don't share at mine. I'll share it at But then I drew for the biggest plate, and before I knew it, the whole plate was just filled, man. And I just thought, you know, what's the point, man?
You've got the point.
But, yeah, you know, You've earned it, mate.
You've earned it.
I hope so, but it doesn't feel good on the stomach, man. I'm telling you, it doesn't feel good at all.
I'm just going to do a quick recap of, and so obviously this is the second part of the interview because the first part we did a couple of weeks ago. So if anyone wants to listen to that, it's still available on Phoenix FM, I believe. And we'll repost the link to the first one as well. So you've got both parts of it. So in the first interview, we talked about your time before you started playing football. Obviously, you were a youngster growing up in Hackney. You got yourself into a bit of trouble. You said you had too much free time on your hands and not really going to school and you should have done things and got involved with some bad people. And essentially that ended up with you serving some prison sentences. But as luck would have it, that turned out to be a good thing. A couple of people in prison decided to have a word with you and sort of persuade you, shall we say, to become a professional footballer. And you then used your time in prison to do that, to work your way towards fitness, to becoming a professional footballer. When you left prison, you then signed for Haringey Borough. And after a season at Haringey Borough, you then signed for the Mighty O's. Have I missed anything?
No, you got it spot on. I don't even think I was at Haringey. I think I was at Haringey Borough for 8 games.
Oh, right. Is that all? Wow.
Yeah. Literally 8 games, and then I got injured. And because, you know, they didn't have no facilities for physiotherapy, so I think the manager of Haringey Borough at the time, Neville Watson, he had a friend called Mickey Springer, and Mickey Springer was the coach of Dartford. So he called him to say if I can go down when they're having training, that right. way I can get treatment. So after 8 games at Haringey, when I got injured, I went down to Dartford. I was travelling down there Tuesday and Thursdays, and I was picking up treatment. But then when I was able to train again, they kind of thought, well, let's just see what you're like anyway.
Yeah.
And, you know, I ended up, I didn't sign for Dartford, but I played about 6 games. But by that stage, I think there was a lot of interest from pro clubs that was looking to see me play. And I think most of that interest came from when I was playing at Haringey Borough. But because I knew I was injured and that I was travelling to Dartford, I managed to play about 5 games for Dartford before the phone call came in from Frank Clark to come on a week's trial for Orient. So, yeah, I wasn't at Haringey for that long.
And then, obviously, you signed for the Orient and you said that was probably bringing that contract home to your mum was your greatest achievement.
Yeah, it was, because I think for myself, I think one of the difficulties that any person that's been to prison has is when you come out, the transition back into normality. And they say most offenders tend to offend within the first 12 months because it's typical. You're coming out, you know, if you haven't got an education, you haven't really worked, you know, you're going to find it difficult for someone to kind of just trust you to come and work for them. So for me, it was key that if I'm going to achieve my goal, staying on street long enough for the opportunity to appear was key.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had to make sure that the guys that I used to hang around with, I can't be hanging around with them often. Although I saw them, but, in you know, before where I just spent all day with them, just hanging out at the podcast, now I had to kind of manage my time properly so that, you know, I didn't get sucked back into that life. And so for me, that was a difficult terrain. Plus, no money. So luckily, you know, I didn't start playing football until July when the season started. I came out of prison 25th of January 1990. So I had to kind of just navigate my way from January to the start of the season, which was difficult because, you know, you're relying on your family and friends, you know, just to have money just to be able to kind of stay afloat. So that was difficult. So by the time I was able to, you know, navigate all of that and then get to play football, Haringey Borough, they didn't have much money, but I think they tried to help as well, give me a £50 here and there and everything. So by the time I got to sign for Leyton Orient, for me that was key because I felt like that was the door that I could now close on one lifestyle and now start concentrating on football, because although I signed for Orient and it was £100 a week, it was something stable, it was something regular. Do you know what I mean? And I can work on that. And I think certain people that was helping me, they were able to help me even more because they see that I was trying and that I got that contract. So if, and I mean, again, Orient were fantastic. I've got to admit, they were, Frank Clark and Peter Eustace, when I explained to them, you know, they were able to supplement some of my rent to get me to live closer to the ground.
Right.
And always said if I needed a £20, £30 just to get me through, just go to Carol. I think it was Carol, can't remember the other lady that used to deal with the finances, that I could just go to them and they will give me it and then they will take it off my wages. So, you know, once I was able to sign the contract, I felt like, you know, what I was trying to keep away from and tiptoe around, I no longer had to tiptoe. Do you know what I mean? I got something stable. The contract meant that, you know what I mean? I got regular money coming in. I can eat. I've got somewhere to live, and I can build from that. So for me, that was that. For me, that was the catalyst to everything else that followed. Really.
Yeah, Jamie.
Yeah, I just think that once you got into the actual nuts and bolts of the club, did you actually kind of find it a real easy fit for you at first?
Absolutely, because again, remember, I've been playing football since 7 years of age. You know, from primary school. You know, when I was a second year, I was playing for the fourth years. By 9 years of age, you know, I was coming in Hackney because every week I'm either playing for Hackney District or I'm playing for London. And then I had to fit in Clapton Rangers on a Saturday and Puma on a Sunday. So for me, football was always what I know. You know, at 10 years of age, I was at Tottenham Schoolboys. I left there by 11, 12, I was at West Ham. You know, at 13, 14, I was at Charlton. So coming into football, the transition was easy because it's something I'm very familiar with. It's what I know. And so, you know, transitioning into that life, it just fit like a glove. And plus, I think, you know, Danny Carter was key in helping me to settle, because obviously Danny came from Hackney, but Danny went to school with a lot of my cousins.
Yep.
So, you know, I knew Danny from when he played for Albion, and I played a couple of games for Albion. So I think Danny helped, even without me even realising he did, but he helped kind of just letting the other guys know that, you know, I'm cool. Because remember, I'm coming in with this mad reputation, been in prison, robbery, do you know what I mean? And that's not your norm in football. So I think Danny Carter kind of spoke, even when I didn't know he was speaking, to the players to say, listen, you know what I mean? Don't look at the reputation. I actually know this guy, and he's okay, to be fair.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not going to ruin everything. So, you know, that helped as well in turn. But again, transitioning into football, that's second nature to me.
Do you know, yeah, that could be a great show, you know, like getting you and Danny on together to just talk about the 3 years that you sort of spent at the Orient in that time. I think that could be a really interesting show as well. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just as long as we don't speak about the nights out.
I was just wondering, Vicky, when you first like kind of got into the team, and you obviously you came on at that great debut at Brentford, was it hard to maintain that kind of level of performance? Was it tricky for you to do that?
You know what? It's funny because what I had to get used to is obviously, you know, being in a squad. I always felt like when I was on trial at Leyton Orient, and I don't mean to sound cocky or anything like that, but I knew after about 3 days that I was in.
Yeah.
I knew because I was training with the reserves and the youth team. And so, you know, you quickly can suss the level, you know, at that time. And I realised that, listen, I'm as good as these guys.
Yeah.
And I think once I build up on my fitness, you know, I think I can kind of not stand heads above shoulders than everybody, but I think my game, you know what I mean, I think I can really make an impact. So, you know, for me, I had to get used to fitness, understanding the game, and knowing that, you know, you've got another player that's fighting for your position. I've always had the luxury of always playing.
Right.
I've never worried about being subbed or if I'm going to play all the way up from 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age, right up until, you know, playing football before I went in prison. And let's be honest, even when I was in prison, I was playing for the prison officers. So I'm used to playing. So for me, coming in now and not having that cushion and having to learn the game and take instructions and, do you know what I mean? That took a while for me to settle. So I think that's what I was battling with. I think, you know, my skill will always come through, but I realised as well you need that consistency of games. And I think in the first season, I think I got that consistency, but then I was dealing with other things. I think when the first 6 games of that season, it was crazy because I think, you know, people saw the potential. Do you know what I mean? That Brentford game, I mean, you know, that was just like me playing in the school. Do you know what I mean? I think it was Ratcliffe. And that set the bar high in terms of now people's got my name on their lips. And so I had to deal with, you know, me, Peter Eustace and Frank Clark. We're sitting there and thinking, look, the press want to know who you are, mate. No one don't know you in youth team football, you know. So we have to send out a story. And so I had to do an exclusive with the people to explain my past. So I had all that to deal with as well. Do you know what I mean? As well as still learning the game, still adapting to professional football. So I think it would have an impact on my performances at times.
Yeah.
But I think I quickly showed the Orient fans that potentially, you know, I think I'm in the right place at the right time. And I think at the right club, if I'm honest, because I didn't move, so I didn't have to relocate. Yeah. So those things are going to help. But I think dealing with rotation, and everything, that's what was really I was dealing with, not so much the performance, but yes, it would have an impact on my performance, but I think I showed enough flashes that I think the crowd got behind that, because what I learned from fans is that they just want to see you trying, they want to see you having a go, do you know what I mean? They don't mind if you try something and it doesn't work out, just get the ball and try again. And I think my kind of game at first was very aggressive. Get the ball. I just want to take on players and either score or set up a goal. You know, I like to pass sideways or pass backwards. So I think the crowd quickly got onto that. And I think that allowed me enough space to make mistakes and maybe not have good performances. But I think the crowd knew what I was trying to do.
I think, you know, Orient have got a history of having, you know, exciting wingers. And, you know, when you look back at the likes of Laurie Cunningham and Alan Comfort and even Danny Carter himself, you know, he was a great winger at the club and stuff. And obviously you were in that mould of players that came in and got people off their seats. You know, we wanted to watch you play.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, it's a crime for my name to be put in the likes of Laurie Cunningham and, dare I say, John Chidozie, because we forget John Chidozie. Do you know what I mean? I didn't think my name warranted being in that group of players because I just came into football. But I think, yeah, I think Orient has always been that kind of club. They want the world. They've been able to always unearth those kind of players. And I think me coming in with that kind of style of play, I think it helped me to settle because I won the fans over very quickly. So, you know, the performances at Bournemouth and everything like that, it kind of set the benchmark for me to kind of settle in. But it also meant I set the bar high for myself, and I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm not going to have a Brentford performance every week.
Yeah.
So all of those things you're kind of battling with as a player, because remember, I'm trying to make a mark in football. I'm not saying that my hunger was more than any other professional, but in the back of my mind is always the reality, I ain't going back to prison.
Yeah.
So I had to always try to perform at some level. And when I didn't perform, I'm a horrible critic with myself when I don't perform, because for me, I can still hear those prison doors slamming and I ain't going back. And you can have one good season in football, but that don't guarantee that you're going to get a career out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So every time I'm trying to do things, and looking back, maybe some of the mistakes was because I was trying too hard. Maybe if I relaxed and just let the game happen, you know, but I was always one of those footballers that when I get the ball, I have to show something, I have to do something. And when I'm not doing it, I get frustrated. So, as I said, there was so much that I had to learn on the mental side of how I manage my performances. And that took time.
Yeah. Do you think your game, would you say your game changed then over the 3 years that you were at the Orient?
I wouldn't say so much change, but I think I started to understand the game more. So if there was any changes, it would only be like, okay, mix it up. You know, sometimes when I get the ball, just play it simple. And I realised that because I had to kind of mix it up with my opponent. Because after a while, you know, opponents learn very quickly. He's pacey. So, you know, don't give him that, you know, you've got to be either close to him.
Yeah.
But, you know, if he gets the ball and turns on you and knocks that ball 10 yards, you're probably not going to win. So I had to learn that. So I had to mix it up. So I wouldn't say my game changed as much. I would like to think that my knowledge of the game was improving, and as a consequence, I had to kind of mix up my game and not always go for the, you know, the two, taking on two, three players and whipping in the ball, but just playing it simple, just so that I can kind of not let my opponent second guess what I'm doing.
I'm glad you mentioned actually about your pace, because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, which is Orient related but not football related, do you remember running in the Rumbelows Sprint Challenge?
Yes.
How did that come about that you were the one that was selected? Was it just like you drew the shortest straw, or like?
Well, I think you know what, it's all these things you notice in pre-season, because remember, I mean, pre-season was no player likes pre-season. And we always used to go to Epping Forest, and so I think it was it was noticed. I'm a good trainer. I'm a good trainer. Once I get going, I'm normally at the front of the pack. And so I'm a good long distance runner. And then when we was doing sprints, so I knew I was quick. And there was only a couple of players that was quick. But you know, it's one of them when the players say, Rick, just slow down, man. Slow down, slow down. but again, in my mind, I'm saying, listen, you guys have been playing football for 3, 4, 5 years. I can hear the prison door slamming. Yeah. I ain't got no time to hold on for you guys. I need to get a bigger contract so I can start to cement my name. So when we're doing pre-season and we're doing sprints, you know, Peter Eustace is looking at me because he knows I'm quick. So he wants me to go quick. But then I've got the player behind me saying, wait, slow down, slow down, slow down. So, you know, I think I still had to be quick, but I had to stick with the players because you have to roll with the players. So I think it was established then that I'm probably one of the quickest players in the club. There were other players that were quite quick. But my quickness is over like 10 yards. Once, boom, 10 yards, I'm gone. Where there's other players, they pick up the speed.
Yeah.
So when it came to the Rumbelow sprint, they just said, Rick, you know, you've got to go into it. But listen, I was coming up against players like Collymore. Now,
yeah.
I thought I was quick. when I raced in that group with Colin Moore and a couple of other players, I'm trying to think who they were. I came about sixth. You know, and then I realised I ain't quick. These guys, they are quick. But yeah, it just came about because, you know, in pre-season, when you're training, you're kind of doing your sprints up the hills. And so, again, like I said, I was very good in training. I was quite fit. And once your body's responding to the training, you know, you're kind of excelling that. So that's how that came about.
I remember watching that, and after about 60 metres, you were like, nah. Yeah, on, on you go.
Because, again, over 10, 15 yards, boom, I'm quick. And then I can keep that. But, I mean, some of those players that I was racing with, I didn't stand a chance, man. Like I said, in that race, it was over Crystal Palace. I came about six. That was it, you know, just a quiet journey home.
Yeah. I mean, because there was actually a big prize for that, wasn't there, at the time? The guy who won, he was a second.
It was, but I can't remember. But I'm sure in the final, there was Stan Collymore was definitely in the final for that one, because he's
Oh, was one of the favourites, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm trying to remember what the prize was, but I can't remember.
I think it was about 10 grand, you know. It was quite a bit of dough.
Yeah. You dug that one out, man. I forgot about that.
I'm just wondering, Ricky, I mean, what was your relationship with Peter Eustace? I mean, he was, I should think, quite a hard taskmaster, but was he, like, firm but fair?
Yeah, I mean, Peter Eustace, they're old school. But again, you have to remember, we're going back to 1990. So, you know, the kind of training that was done then, you know, that today, that'd be like prehistoric. It's dinosaur. Do you know what I mean? With all science that's in the game today, it wasn't like that back then. But Peter Eustace was old school. But I think the good thing that happened, because after training, sometimes when we'll get back to the ground and we're sitting in the changing room, you know, he took the time to kind of sit down and listen to some of the things that I, you know, the life that I was living. He was interested in that because I think he wanted to learn to understand me as well. So I think he'd know how to coach me, because I think there was one time, I think I've been at the club about 3 months, and, you know, in training is brutal, you know. You know, the manager, there's no bars hold on language and how they will talk to you, sort of thing. And one day he just ranted and raved at me, man. And I don't know if he saw a look in my face, but I was looking to move to him. I was looking to think, who are you talking to? I caught myself, you know. I realised where I was, because when he spoke to me like that, you know, on the street, you know, that's violent talk.
Yeah.
And on the street, you know, you don't let something like that pass up. So I think I got caught between a rock and a hard place, because when he ran and raved at me, a look come over my face as if to say, who the hell is... And then I caught myself and let go. So I think a couple of days later, he came and sat down and we spoke, and he was just saying, look, you know, I've got to remember where you're coming from, and I don't want you to think it's personal or anything like that. So we used to have a lot of good conversations, and I think he was genuinely intrigued with how I actually got caught up in that. Because again, I think for them, when you actually talk to me, you realise that, I'm not thick, I'm not stupid, but at the same time, I wasn't easily led.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I think he was intrigued to find out how, you know, what happened, why did you go down that road? And I think it helped him to understand me more and so how he can coach me better. So, yeah, they were old school, very firm, very... You know what I mean? In training, they want you to give you a roar, but I think you can still see the person in them. And for me, I have to see that, because they saw the person in me and not the crimes, not the lifestyle, not the baggage. So, you know, they were excellent for me personally. But yeah, they were old school. You train hard, you know, you work hard, and then, you know, you reap your rewards.
And someone else who showed great faith in you was Barry Fry. Because obviously, after 3 years at the Orient, you then moved to Southend initially for £100,000. And he then took you on to Birmingham after one season at Southend for what was then a club record fee of £800,000. You mentioned last time we spoke about how training with Barry Fry was totally different to what it was with Eustace and Clark, because with Barry Fry, it was a case of just get on the pitch and do your stuff. What sort of made you make that decision to, first of all, move to Southend, and then obviously you were only at Southend for a year before you then moved across to Birmingham?
Well, I think initially, I think after about 2 years at Owen, Coventry City came in for me.
Yeah.
And I had to go up to Coventry to speak to them. Now, at the time, you know, Coventry, you know, the Premiership was only about 2 years old, and Coventry was in the Premiership. Now, obviously, it was a great opportunity for me, and I had a kind of idea of what figure I would like to have. But I was kind of pre-warned that, you know, Bobby Goldie's one of those kind of managers. He always wants to get players on the cheap. So I was going up there without an agent, because agents was only just kind of filtering into football at that time. Do you know what I mean? So I went up there, and obviously he tried to get me on the cheap. And what he offered, it was just derisory. I think he didn't understand that, listen, I'm coming from London.
Yeah.
I have to relocate. You know what I mean? What you're offering me here, where do you expect me to live on those wages?
Yeah.
And so he can see I'm getting kind of annoyed. And he tried to sell me the, yeah, but you're going to be playing at the Old Traffords and the Hybrids and everything. But I'm trying to say to him, yeah, but where am I going to live?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you mean? I don't know if they just thought, you know, because I'm just a next con that, you know, don't muck about with an next con, because we know about our figures. We know our figures. And I know to myself that what he was offering, that ain't even going to give me a mortgage deposit.
Yeah. And those,
do you know what I mean?
Those are the sorts of things that people don't realise, obviously, when people are thinking about, you know.
Listen, all people saw on the news in the evening is that Ricky O's turned down and moved to Coventry. And everyone's saying, how can you? You're in Division 2. You're turning down the Premiership. What? But people don't understand. Where do you expect me to live once I relocate from London to the Midlands?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He offered me £10,000 signing on fee. After tax, you're left with six.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What am I going to do with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
What am I going to do with that? Where do you expect me to live? In the digs with the youth team?
Yeah.
So when I was explaining it to him, he couldn't understand. He just thought that I can just sell you Highbury, Old Trafford and White Hart Lane. Bruv, after playing at White Hart Lane, where am I living? You know, so I got annoyed with him and I just walked out. I just turned down the deal.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Frank Clark and Peter Eustace, I think they was a little bit upset, but I think they understood that, listen, I can't relocate on that money.
Yeah.
No.
And at the same time, I'm not going to let you guys exploit me just because I come out of prison.
Yeah.
So it's not going to happen. So I think things were a little bit frosty for a couple of months, because I think after that, I wasn't playing in the first team, but my contract was up.
Right.
And I think once they realised, well, you're not playing in the first team, fine, cool. I don't care. I'll sit down there until another opportunity comes. I think that's when, you know, Peter Eustace, he comes, sat down and said, look, you know, you're one of us. You know what I mean? They can see I was down. The mood collapsed. And so we kind of renegotiated another contract, which I was happy to sign. So I think after that, I think it was clear that somewhere along the line, I will move on.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to play at a higher standard. I think the way how things was at Orient, we was never really pushing for promotion. We was more of a mid-table team.
Yeah.
And so we was in a second division. So I realised that if Coventry City came in for me, then obviously, you know what I mean, other interests may come, maybe in a higher league. So I'll wait to see what kind of opportunity will come. So when the Southend opportunity come, Southend was a team I've never even considered, never looked at, never played against them. But they were playing in the first division.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean? So I felt to myself, well, it's a step up.
Yeah.
Hey, if I can deal in the first division, then obviously that may give me confidence to kind of move forward and get to the highest echelons of football. So I took the move because I felt like after 2.5-3 years, you know, I'd learned a lot from Orient. Do you know what I mean? My game improved, but now I was ready for a new challenge. And so Southend was the only team that came in at the time. I learned a little bit about Barry Fife. And this is the truth. What made me sign for him, it wasn't so much him and how we trained, but there was a player called Andy Clark.
Yeah.
Andy Clark.
He's playing in Wimbledon.
That's right. He played at Bath, he played for Barnet, and then went to Wimbledon. Well, I think it was 1988. There was a game between Feltham Young Offenders Institutions and Huntercombe. Mm-hmm. Andy Clark was playing for Huntercombe and I was playing for Feltham. And we lost 4-3. He scored 4 goals and I scored 3. And I noticed from then. So what happened was, when I came out of prison in 1990, within weeks, it was on the news that, Man United and Arsenal, they were looking at this player. And when the face come up, you know, because you don't forget Andy Clark's face. Right? But his face came up. And because I didn't know initially, I didn't know him, but I saw his face come up. And then when I saw that he was playing for Barnet, and I thought to myself, gosh, if my man can do it, so can I. So that gave me confidence when I saw that, okay, he was playing non-league football at Barnet. Now he done well at Barnet that these top clubs were coming in for him. So when Barry Fry came in for me, I think one of the reasons why I signed for Barry Fry is because I realised that I can play for another manager that, again, can look past my criminal past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just look at me totally for football. And it sounds bizarre, but those things mean something to us when we're coming out of chaotic lifestyles and still having to deal with certain idiosyncrasies and mannerisms and behaviours. You always feel a little bit more comfortable that you're with someone that may just understand why you do what you do or say what you say. So for me, that played a big part of, although, you know, Southend wasn't a massive club, but I think I was going to a manager that kind of may understand me again. And that's what I needed, because that's what I got from Orient. I was with people that saw past my criminal past and gave me space to be able to mature. And I felt that I would get that at Southend. So that's why I signed.
And you played 64 games for Southend. You scored in 17 goals. And then from there, Barry Fry obviously took you on to Birmingham. Now, it's been, oddly enough, see, you still live in Birmingham, but it's been said that people said that you didn't settle in Birmingham at the club because you ended up going out on loan a few times. What was that experience like?
After Southend, because I think Southend, see, at Orient, I had the foundation that was needed for, I think, the next, you know, for the performances that I done at Southend. I think that came off the back of having that good, firm foundation at Orient. Because when I got to Southend, now I was playing every game.
Yeah.
So I was settled, and I quickly established myself in that team. And I realised that, you know, knowing that you're playing week in and week out, it helps in terms of just how you navigate yourself through the week in training and everything like that. Plus, your confidence is sky high. So, you know, I think that I played a lot of my best football at Southend because most of my performances was like Brentford-esque. It was like the Brentford old,
red.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was chipping in with goals and I was setting up goals. So I played my best football there. And so, you know, I kind of realised that Barry Fry, he takes a lot of players with him. So the camaraderie in Southend was great. It was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So when Barry Fry left, we were sitting third in the league at the time in Division One, and no team really wanted to play us. You know, we was going to all the big sides and we was just like battering them. Yeah. So I think if Barry Fry stayed, I really think something crazy would have happened in terms of promoting the Premier League, because everything was just clicking.
Yeah. Did you play with Andy Sussex at Southend?
Yes. Yeah. Andy Sussex, great guy. And so when I signed for Birmingham, it was a completely different dynamic. partly because I think for Barry now, you know, this was his first major club where he had, you know, a big budget to work with. And we've spoken, me and Barry have spoken before about this. And, you know, he has confirmed that, you know, at the time with all the budget, you know, it just got out of hand. He was buying players every week, you know. And when I got to Birmingham, by the end of that season, because I joined in December 94, so Birmingham was in the second division, but they were kind of favourites to go up. So by the end of that season, there were 52 pros on the books.
Oh,
52 pros on the books.
Incredible. You know?
And so it was just chaos, you know, from one to the next. You don't know whether you're playing. You find out that you're playing on a Saturday. And for me, the dynamic was completely different. At Southend, we had a small club. So, you know what I mean? You're working with less players. But that worked. I thought Barry would have adopted the same kind of personnel. But I think with all the money that Barry had to spend, every time they seemed like there was a problem in the team, he felt the thing was to go and buy another player.
Yeah.
So as a player, you don't build that momentum. You know, and when you're moving for big money, unfortunately, I think you don't get much time to settle in. Especially, I think what Barry Fry done, he built me up as a striker.
Sure.
Because I scored 15 goals at Southend and I was setting up. I think when he went in to the Gold Brothers and Sullivan and Karen Brady to get the money for me, at the time, I think he felt that the club needed a striker. And so he sold me to them as a striker. So the club is expecting me to come as a striker. So when I come, I'm a left midfielder.
Yeah.
So those initial months, it took a little while before the crowd kind of understood my game. But I think once they understood my game, you know, I think the report built up a little bit. It built up. It was good. But again, what I think I needed was consistency in terms of playing time.
Yeah.
And because you don't get that consistency, it's almost like when you do come on or when you are playing, you've got to perform. And if I'm honest, I don't think I ever picked up momentum. Again, I'm relocated to a new area, don't know no one, not making excuses, but I think how you start off tends to kind of filter through to how, you know, people will view your game. And remember, my game was always built on you know, getting results, man. You know what I mean? And I just wasn't performing how I performed at Southend at Birmingham. And so I think Birmingham didn't really see the best of me. And I'd be the first to admit that.
You did have a highlight at Birmingham, though, didn't you? Because you scored at Anfield.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, first I had to get over scoring an own goal on my debut. Which was absolutely crazy because that was probably the loneliest night in Birmingham because I remember when I scored the own goal and I got back to the hotel and everyone's around the reception, all the staff, and none of them would look me in the eye. I was like, give me the key, and I just went upstairs. And they were all kind of shit. I don't know what to say. Just give me the key, man. I'm going upstairs. I didn't come out the room until the next day. But yeah, I mean, you know, playing at Liverpool, let's start off with playing at Liverpool because, you know, when I grew up in the 70s, Liverpool was the team. Do you know what I mean? I grew up under that Liverpool team. So for me to actually play at Anfield, you know, I actually was going there like a tourist, you know. And, and then I kind of remind myself, hold on a minute, Rick, get yourself together because you're here to play a game. But I was like a tourist. I was touching the bricks. I was touching everything. Anfield. You know, to kind of play there. And that was a replay, by the way, because we played them at St. Andrew and drew 0-0. And then, you know, went up to Anfield to play. And so to score was absolutely... Even now, sometimes I still watch the goal. There's moments that you don't realise it will live with you for the rest of your life. You do it at the time because it's what you do. It's your occupation. You know, you want to score. But, you know, people still remind me of it even now. But at the time, when we drew, it went to penalties. And I remember Barry Fife come over to me and said, Rick, you want to take a penalty? I was like, no. I don't score my night. I've scored at Anfield. I know half of Hackney are just jumping because half of my friends, they're all Liverpool fans. So yeah. I don't want to spoil anything. I've scored at Anfield. My job done. I don't care what happens after this. I was like, taking a penalty. Albeit, we never scored a penalty. All the players that took a penalty missed anyway. But yeah, you know, scoring at Anfield was definitely up there with one of those achievements that now, retired, you know, being able to just have that in your locker is a little trouble out every now and then, just to remind myself that I was so slim.
Also, that season, you ended up playing at Wembley as well, didn't you? In the
another great occasion. We played in the the auto windscreen.
Oh, right, okay.
Auto windscreen shield, and funnily enough, the week before there was the FA Cup final. I'm trying to remember who it was with, but we had more at that game than the FA Cup final between the Premiership clubs. There was 76,000 that came to Wembley, and 55,000 of those were Blue Nose. So,
wow.
For me, again, 55,000 were Blue Nose. So, again, if you can imagine, like, leaving getting on the coach from, we stayed at the Marriott at the time. I think it was called the Marriott off the M25. And driving, and we're coming closer to Wembley. It's like, growing up as a kid, when I'm seeing the Wembley Way, and it's packed in the coming. It's actually like that.
Wow.
I mean, I was sweating, man. I was dying. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand that all of us as footballers, we were all kids. Grew up watching FA Cup final. Do you know what I mean? We grew up, and I grew up on an estate. And if you was an Arsenal fan or Tottenham fan, scarves everywhere, pictures everywhere. So you know, as professional footballers, we are kids. And the minute when we got to Wembley Way, and honestly, it hit us because all you saw was a sea of blue. I think that moment, all of us just became kids again, and we was hanging out the window looking. The only thing we didn't have, because imagine, there was no mobile phones.
Yeah, yeah.
No social media. So all we had was just eyes to just look. And honestly, you know, I think a lot of us was choked, because to actually see it, we've seen it growing up on television, but to actually live it, I mean, gosh, you just knew then, we can't lose, man.
Yeah.
We can't lose. And so it was a great day. And it was the first time that any final had to be played by sudden death.
Right.
Yeah, so...
Right.
It got to extra time played out, and then it got to sudden death. And you know, sudden death, every time Carlisle got the ball up their half, man, I was you know, you're cacking it, and you're thinking, please, no. Dude, as soon as the goalie gets the ball, you relax. I say, right, come on, this, you know, it was like that, cat and mouse. And then I set up the goal. It was crazy. It was crazy. But honestly, when the ball went in, that noise, I mean, I can even remember when it went in, the commentator, every word that he said from when it crossed, hit Tate's head, and he just says, Tate has done it. And for the first time in Wembley history, we can say with absolute certainty, that's a winner. That was the commentator. You know what I mean? And it was, you know, to be at Wembley, and it was the old Wembley.
Yeah.
The old Wembley. Me walking up those 39 steps, and if you think of the players that have walked up them steps, listen, man, if that was way up there, way up there. You know what I mean? And to win, it was a beautiful feeling, man.
Ricky, we've only got about five minutes left. Sorry, Jay. We've only got about 5 minutes left, Ricky. I'm quite keen to talk to you about, obviously, your life after football. And obviously, five minutes is a lot of time to cram everything in. But you're now a pastor, and you work as a probation officer with young offenders and stuff. How did that come out? When you were coming up towards retirement, were you worried about what you were going to do? Or did you always have this sort of thing in mind?
Well, you know, I didn't have the luxury of coming up to my retirement. I retired through injury.
Right, right.
So I'd done all my knee ligaments and I retired. But I knew very early on in my career that, listen, this ain't your norm. You know, you don't go to prison five times, come out and then achieve your boyhood dream and have all that experience for nothing. So I knew early on that whatever I do after this, it had to do with working with offenders. Do you know what I mean? Because it just made perfect. Coming from where I'm coming from, now that I've transformed my life, I realised that, listen, when I left prison, I left a lot of rickety-olds in prison. What I mean by that is that I left a lot of people in prison that were talented, gifted. But what tends to happen when people leave prison, they get on with their life, and if they're successful, they just continue to move on.
Sure.
For me, I realised that, listen, if my life is going to mean anything, I'm going to have to go back to prison, Rick. And try to help out in some way, shape, or form. I didn't know how. I just kind of realized that was probably the best path for me. Not to be a football coach, not to be a manager. Nah, for me, I had to go back. So I didn't know how. But luckily, my cousin, he was a probation officer in Reading.
Right.
And that he used to do group facilitation. So you work with offenders in groups. And so depending on the crime, if it's drink driving or if it's substance misuse or acquisitive crimes, what you do when you join the probation, you get trained up on how to deliver these programs, and then you start working with offenders. So my cousin kind of briefed me before I even got injured that, Rick, this will be good for you, man, to give something back and to go. So, it made perfect sense for me. So when I retired, that's what I done. I went to the probation, joined the probation, learned these new skills. Because remember, I was at school at 14 years of age, never done a day's work in my life. Right. Do you know what I mean? So, you know... But the probation offered that kind of a platform where you didn't really need any experience other than life's experience. Sure. And I had life experience in a bundle. Yeah. You know what I mean? So even when I done my interview, because when you do your interview for the probation service, you have to kind of do a 10-minute presentation of your life and why you think you can suit fit well within in the service. So I've done my life based on the Maslow's hierarchy of needs charts, the five specific needs. Someone needs, but I've done it from where I was into crime and where I got to self-actualization as a footballer and now wanting to work with defenders. And even when I done that, there was a silence, an eerie silence that came over the five panelists. Do you know what I mean? They were just stunned.
Yeah.
And so I knew I got the job then, and that's what I done. I got trained up and started working and doing the program. But what I done, some of the material can be quite condescending.
Right.
And good thing about me, I was able to bring my own experience to the program. So a lot of the times when the guys knew who I was and where I'm coming from, you can hear a pin drop. And so I got all the difficult cases. And sure. Most people, they wanted to work with me because with me, I was able to speak to the offenders on a certain level that they understood. So even the worst offenders, they respected my program and they acquiesced to what I asked them to do. So what I done, I started my own company. That's where I met my wife. I met my wife in the service. And right. She had the same passion to work with offenders. So we said, you know what? Let's start our own company so that we can make it more bespoke. And that's what I've done. So then the service contracted us to go in and work with the offenders. So that's what I've been doing. Now I've been doing some work in the prisons because my journey was always to get to the prison.
Yeah.
So a lot of patient work you can do in the community. But now, over the last 2-3 years, I've made inroads towards the prison, and that's what I've been doing. And along that way, you know, I gave my life to the Lord. I became a Christian, but I was always kind of, you know, spiritually minded.
Sure.
So that took on another kind of a journey for me in terms of, you know, growing and becoming a pastor and going to study, do a degree in theology. So all of those helped in terms of what I believe I can do to help offenders know themselves spiritually and humanly.
Ricky, thank you ever so much for your time. We really, really appreciate it. One question before I go. Obviously, Orient are playing Southend tonight. Who do you want to win?
I'm conflicted. this is where you just want to draw, isn't it? If I had to be honest, if I had to be honest, I think where Orient is right now, they're just outside of the playoffs. You know, Southend, they've just managed to get off the bottom of the table.
Yeah.
So I think I would love to see Southend win only because it helps them to move off the bottom. And I think Orient fans hopefully can just accept that, look, you can drop, just for me, you can drop 3 points, right? And you're not in a relegation battle. Because again, remember, Orient, after what's happened at Orient for the last couple of years, you know, to get back to where we are now, I still think they can reach higher. And I'm really hoping for them to get promotion this year. They've got to push for promotion this year. At the moment, it's looking like if they can get into that playoffs and stay in that playoff, and then hopefully if we can get through to the playoffs, get back into League One, that will be great. But I would hate to see Southend get relegated from the Football League. So, you know, ideally a draw is good, but if you want me to stick my neck out, I'll stick my neck out, but this is compassionate sticking my neck out. You know what I mean? Love to see Southend get a couple more points so that we can just come away from the relegation zone.
Well, Ricky, thank you ever so much for your time. Do us all a favour and ask the big man upstairs if he can fulfil that prophecy of getting us into the playoffs and getting us up. That would be lovely. You take care of yourself, mate.
Thanks for having me, man. All the best.
Thanks, Ricky. Right,
take care, Ricky. Bye-bye, mate. Bye-bye now. So that's it from us at the Orient Hour tonight. Thank you for Ricky Otto. Thank you to Jamie for joining me online. And I'd like to wish you all a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year from everyone here at the Orient Hour. Best wishes for 2021. Take care, and we'll see you next time.
This ain't Upton Park, it's Brisbane Road. It ain't White Hart Lane, that's the wrong postcode. It ain't Stamford Bridge. This is E10, and you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again. There's flats in every corner of the ground. You can get your kids in just £5. Get an Orient here, it's only a quid. Get a cup of tea, but there ain't no lids, cos it's an Upton Park, it's Brisbane Road. It ain't White Hart Lane, it's a wrong postcode, it ain't Stamford Bridge. This is E10, and you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again. We had an FA Cup 78. We had John Cena, that is most irate. We were club reviver, but we don't care. We had checkered shirts, we had Chris Tate's hair. Still scored. I remember it's done on the message board. I remember the pleasure. I remember the pain. And I want to hear rocking all over the world again. This ain't Upton Park, it's Brisbane Road. It ain't White Hart Lane, that's a wrong postcode. It ain't Stamford Bridge, this is E10. And you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again. A wrong postcode, it ain't Stamford Bridge. This is E10, and you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again. So come on, Orient, it's our passport. I'll stay till the end if I thought you'd score, but I haven't seen a goal in God knows when. And I wanna hear rocking all over the world. It's ain't Upton Park, it's Brisbane Road. It ain't White Hart Lane, that's a wrong postcode. It ain't Stamford Bridge, this is E10. And you're gonna hear rocking all over the world again. Cos it's ain't Upton Park, it's Brisbane Road. It ain't White.
On the hour, across Brentwood and Billericay, this is Phoenix FM News.